function here, as I've sort of defined it over the last 5 or 6 years, is A, obviously to teach meditation techniques, but then also I think equally as valuable is to try to introduce the tools that the Buddha developed 2,500 years ago to end stress and suffering, so that these tools, which are somewhat endangered, can be used and can be put into practice. I say somewhat endangered because the Buddha's ideas are invariably in the media and in very odd places, even word to mouth, the way people sort of just casually refer to his teachings, often they get quite distorted. And I was watching TV last night, an embarrassingly hollow show that I love to watch. One of those vampire shows, which are so addictive. I watch, there's a couple of vampire shows I'm addicted to. And one of the characters looked to the other and said, "Don't you know the Buddha said life is suffering?" And I died a little, because it's a show I love. But the Buddha didn't say that, you know? And I wish I could arrive as a character in the show. And just say, no, that's not what the Buddha said. In life, there is suffering. Not all of life is suffering. There's a difference. Another show, My Name is Earl, used to present the entire idea of karma as what goes around comes around. And that has nothing to do with what karma is. Nothing to do with what karma is. Karma is a psychological teaching, which is we actually are the owners of our own happiness and our own suffering. We create it through the way we use our minds. If we act skillfully, we wind up in living in a skillful mind. And if we act out of ignorance and anger and hatred and craving, then we wind up in suffering and minds that are constantly stressed out, believing that there's this happiness out there that we somehow weren't given, and we have to cram it in by controlling the world and owning as much as we can. So one of the big ideas that is constantly misinterpreted or misrepresented is the idea of attachment. You probably heard or somebody's told you that there's a great deal of talk about attachment in Buddhism, but then people generally don't know much more than that when they haven't really devoted a lot of study and endeavor with monks and work with the actual text of what the Buddha taught. There's this idea that Buddhism is somehow just detaching from everything, which sounds like a sort of an exercise in aloofness. Or like the idea is to become like Mr. Spock on Star Trek, you know, where we walk around with raised eyebrows in a cynical distance and removed from everything, not thrown anymore, not in any way engaged with anything, a sort of almost like Scandinavian remove, I'll say. That makes no sense, but I'll just say it anyway. But that's not what attachment, that's not what the teachings is. The actual teaching, it's going to be a couple of classes. I'm going to sort of break it down into what is unskillful, what is attachment, what's the unskillful kind, and then next week I'm going to talk about what are the skillful kinds of attachments, or what are the things we can attach to that will strategically, if we work with them, if we do focus on them, will bring happiness. So that should give you an immediate idea that not everything is toxic. The general idea is that the human mind is set up to be very anxious and to constantly look around for an edge. we were genetically set up the way to live the way the world was 40,000 years ago, and it was a very dangerous place. The brain hasn't really changed very much in the last 40,000 years, so even though the world's become a very, in comparison, safe place, we still walk around with minds that think at any moment we could be eaten or stampeded or killed by, you know, roving clans or whatever. So the brain is set up with a couple of different subsystems that see everything before we become consciously aware of it. These are sort of pre-conscious subsystems. And one of them is the amygdala, and the other one is the hypothalamus. And they get a look at everything before we are consciously aware of anything we see or experience. And these are very dumb parts of the brain. They are really dumb. And they'll look at anything, and if anything reminds them of something that in the past caused you stress, or in the past was a good opportunity, it will do a number of things. It'll first start a lot of stress in the body to alert you that something's out there that you should pay attention to. And it'll start to focus your attention. It'll start to shrink your attention around the thing. And then it will also fire lots of dopamine, which creates thought. Those three things are what the Buddha actually said are the way to know when you're in craving and clinging or attachment. Those very three same things. The body, he called it dukkha vedana. The body becomes stressful whenever we encounter something that we like or dislike. Then the next thing is the awareness shrinks, tamayata. We don't become aware of our breathing or our body or anything else. We just focus on the thing itself. And then finally, there is papancha, the proliferation of obsessive thought born of craving. Papancha literally means multiplying times 10. So anyway, there's three things that happen when you see something that your unconscious mind decides is good or bad. You've got the physical stress, the vedana dukkha, then you've got the shrinking of the awareness, tamayata, and then you've got finally the papancha, the obsessive thought. So that's a clue. If you notice, oh my God, I notice suddenly that when I'm around this person, it feels like, some people say love, when they first met the person they love, it felt like somebody punched them in the stomach. It's very interesting that sometimes the things that we crave and the things we're averse to, the two sensations physically are very similar. That's because they work the exact same way. They just are but a bunch of muscle contractions. That's the way your mind, your subconscious mind speaks to your body, which then in turn speaks back to you. It's a circuitous route. You think that the subconscious mind would have been able to learn language or something like that, but it doesn't speak. So it needs to use another route. It goes down, releases all these peptides and hormones, adrenaline and stuff like that, stresses and tenses out the body, then it goes back up in a part of the brain called the insula. Do you really want to know? No, you don't. Okay, anyway. So that's the process. And the Buddha, in his Paticca-samuppada, his explanation of the way stress arises through each and every perception we have, said that exact same route, which has now been borne out by neurobiology, that we see something, we get a physical sensation, we then have a craving that focuses our attention, and then we have clinging, where there's lots of thought that come about it. So there you go. That's the main thing that's going on, that same route over and over again. And there's lots of different metaphors that people have used to explain this over the ages. 2,300 years ago, whenever Buddhaghosa was alive, he was an early monk who wrote something called the Abhidhamma, which is a sort of early criticisms or explanations of the Pali Canon. And he said that the best way to think of this is, imagine everyone is a thief. Everybody in the world is a thief. And whenever we see something that we want, that's when we go into craving. We want to take it. We want to own things. We want to grab it. And that causes a amount of stress, because the thief is always worked up and trying to figure out, how can I get this thing? And then when we actually grab it and own it, we are never comfortable because we're scared it will be taken away from us. we've taken something, we've stolen something. And so in throughout the entire process of looking through for lasting security outside of ourselves, which we are genetically set up to do, by the way, 40,000 years ago, you weren't going to find lasting security by meditating. You probably would be killed. I'm sorry to say that, but there weren't a lot of people who had the luxury back then of sitting around meditating. Basically, you were lucky to live 20 to 20. You constantly had to be scrounging around for food. Starvation was a big issue. Illness was a big issue. And danger was everywhere. So you didn't really have the brain is not set up to find peace within. It's just not set up. Which is another reason that the Buddha never taught something called Buddha nature, because he knew darn well that the mind is simply not naturally a machine that is comfortable with itself. It's actually an anxiety, anxiousness machine. You're all natural-born worriers. Not natural-born killers, you're natural-born worriers. That's the way the brain is set up. Okay, so that's one metaphor, the metaphor of a thief. Another Buddhist, Richard Gombrich, who's a professor of a very famous professor, talked about how the Buddha had a fire sermon, and he said suffering was like a fire, and clinging was the fuel. When we're attaching to something, we're putting fuel to the fire of our mental stress and agitation, and that nibbana is another word for putting out the fire. It means, nibbana literally means breathing out, letting a fire go. I don't like that metaphor. It makes no sense to me, but I thought I would share it, but I've tried to share it in such a biased way that you won't be tempted to use it. If you want to read it and use it, look up Richard Gombrich's work and maybe it'll be helpful to you. I find the most useful version of it to be my teacher, Ajahn Jeff, uses the metaphor of feeding. The word for craving, when we see something first and we want it to bring us happiness, but we don't have it yet, it's tanha. And tanha really means to develop an appetite. And the word for clinging, when we actually get a hold of it, is upadana. And that literally means to feed and consume and to seek nourishment from. So literally, the Buddha was using words that were based on digestion. And he's basically saying that the way we interact with the world is that we sort of consume the world. How do we consume it? We focus our attention. That's part of like the developing the appetite. And then when we are focused on it, we create all sorts of thought about it, which is our way of breaking down the world into little digestible parts. And when we come up with ideas that feel good, that's the way we've digested the world. We've turned the world that is very complex and scary and frightening and remote into little digested little bits of thought shit that we can carry around and make ourselves feel safe and superior because we've broken down the very complex, scary, frightening reality into little tags, little idea clouds that make us think that we're very on top of it all and understand reality and have an edge over everybody else. So that's what feeding off of the world means. It means we look around, we see something that we think might give us an edge or might be dangerous for us, and then we focus on it, and then we consume it. Now, just like food, the Buddha said, there are certain foods that are or stuff that we eat that are delicious in the short term, but are shit in terms of their nutrition. In other words, there's like candy bars and saturated fats, and there's pizza, and there's all sorts of fast foods, and they taste delicious, but in the long term, they make you feel crappy, and they don't do anything good for your health. And that's the same thing that we tend to naturally gravitate towards. We tend to gravitate towards things that make us feel good in the short term, regardless over what the long-term mental nutritional value of these things we're focusing on. So, for example, like me, we we might fixate on True Blood or some vampire show, and it feels great to watch because, after all, you have all these sexy people who are sucking each other's blood. Who wouldn't want to? Who wouldn't want to watch that for hours and hours in and in? But no, I only watch one episode of Reeds. But you see that, and it feels so good when you're watching it. In the long term, though, is it adding anything that's going to create long-term happiness and inner peace? No. I can tell you that. I've been watching these shows. There's no lasting nutritional value to them. On the other hand, there is also, in food, there's stuff that doesn't taste so great, but in the long term is very nutritious. I ate a whole pound of broccoli today for lunch, and boy am I suffering. I just want to tell you that. Boy am I suffering. But most of the time I'm eating it under the idea that in some long-term future it's going to pay off for me somehow. Right now I have no idea how that's going to happen, but I have the faith that by eating that broccoli, good things are going to, it's going to build up some vital, the fiber, and there's other things. There's, you know, leafy green vegetables, there's beans, there's whole grains, there's all the stuff basically you don't like to eat, but that people tell you to eat, and very slowly, as an adult, you force yourself to eat. So the same thing with the things we focus on. There are things that feel really good in the short term, and the long term are not nutritious mentally. And then there's the things that we don't really like to think about, like gratitude. We love to think about all the things we don't have and how we compare unfavorably and what terrible things are going to happen to us in the future and worry about what people are thinking about us. And those are mental junk food. And then on the other hand, there's mental health food, which is stuff like gratitude, reflecting on the stuff we do have so we don't have to send ourselves out on an external. Somebody close the back door so that. Thank you very, very much. Of course, that should keep the heat even more in this room, but whatever. You all get extra spiritual stars for sitting through this tonight. Long term, some thoughts are good in the long term, like gratitude, goodwill, generosity, appreciation of virtuous things we've done. I'm going to talk about this whole list next week and the list of skillful reflections, skillful things to think about and to focus on. So, but just for tonight, I'm going to talk about the four kinds of things that we feed off of that are bad for us in the long term. The Buddha came up with a list of four. The Buddha came up with many, many lists, but he came up with one famous list of the four different kinds of clinging foods that we tend to consume, mental foods that are not good for us. So, finally, I should also mention that there are some foods that you can eat once in a while, and they're very good for you. But if you eat them all the time, they're not good for you. For example, like as a veggie, I overeat tofu. And it's not great when you eat it all the time. It's fine when you eat it once in a while. If you eat fish, a little bit of fish is terrific for you. But if you eat a lot of fish, it's got mercury in it, and it's not that healthy for you. So there are some foods that are terrible in the long term. Some foods that are terrific in the long time, you can eat leafy greens and beans forever. You'd be an unpleasant person to live with, but you could do it forever. You could theoretically eat those things and live for a very long time. And then there's the food that you can eat once in a while that's perfectly healthy, but if you eat them all the time. And that's one of the things to bear in mind when we talk about next week, which is, a lot of the thoughts that are skillful, they're only skillful if you do them in the right time. If you try to be only generous all the time, that's not very skillful, and it's not going to make you happy in the long run. There's times to be generous. There's times that if you give away everything without any thought of making yourself self-sustaining, the Buddha said that that's not very skillful. Unless you're going to become a monk and then live as part of the renunciate community. But that's another issue. So you get the idea. There's a balance. And we'll talk about that more next week. But for the four things that cause stress and suffering from clinging. The first thing is kam upadana. And upadana is the word for attachment, clinging. It really means feeding off of things. And kam means sensual pleasure. So feeding off of the things that make us feel good. We talked about how we walk around with a lot of stress whenever we see something, or just in general, we're physically stressed out because we always feel ill at ease. But then whenever we see something that seems like it's a threat or might be something that could be an opportunity, we even have even more physical stress. The stomach tightens, the shoulders get tight, the jaw might get locked, the throat might feel strangled. Everybody holds their Veda Naduka, their gut feelings, in a different way. So you feel this underlying discomfort in life, and one of the things we look for is anything that will make us feel good in the short term, damn the long term consequences. I'm going to focus and consume food, sex, my favorite TV shows. I'm going to sit around and think about that relationship that I'm just in for 2 days, but I'm going to live in it. I'm not going to think about anything else in my life. I'm going to just think about how great it would be. I'm going to sit around and think about how wonderful it was that somebody said something nice to me. I'm going to sit around and focus my mind on all the things that feel just terrific in the short term. And unfortunately, what I'm training my mind to do is look for happiness outside of itself. Constantly, I'm training and I'm practicing my mind that if I feel uncomfortable in my body, the thing to do is to focus and think about something that is conditional, that doesn't last, something that is a very passing, fleeting. You know, for instance, if I'm stressed out at work, some people think about, oh, I can't wait until that vacation comes. That's when I can relax. Or I can't wait until the weekend comes. That's when I'm allowed to relax. Or I can't wait until I get home tonight. So there's this constant idea with kam upadana that the happiness that we're seeking is always off into the future. That's another thing about kam upadana. It's looking for some physical short-term pleasure, but there's also a nature to it. It's often not there, and we have to create it and grab it and work towards it, and it's very conditional. For instance, if you're a crack addict, how conditional is that, right? You got to find the crack, you got to deal with the people that sell the crack, you got to get the implements to use the crack, you got to find a place to use the crack, you got to put up with other people who are using crack, then you got to come down from the crack, then you got to get more money to get more crack so you can hang out with more crack addicts, right? That is what a lot of human kamasavas, or kamupadanas, excuse me, are about. Kamasava is the sort of flowing out of the body, looking for it, that comes with the craving, and kamupadana is when we found it and we're feeding off of it. So that's the first kind, just thinking and fixating on the things that make us feel good in the short term that are in fact very contingent and don't last and are generally extremely short-term sensual pleasures. There's nothing wrong with enjoying them, but part of feeding off of things is really trying to keep them going longer than they're meant to last. People will become so addicted to certain things in their life that they'll just focus on earning more and more money just to get more and more of that thing, rather than just allow that thing that brings them passing pleasure just to arise and pass. We want to have it around us all the time, and we need more and more and more of it. There was this great study about businessmen who, when they make their first $1 million in a deal, they feel a certain bump up in baseline happiness, and then it goes back down after a few months. And then to get the same amount of baseline happiness bump, they have to make $5 million. Then that goes down in a few months. Then they have to make $20 million. So each time the amount of sensual pleasure or fleeting pleasure, you've got to get more and more and more and more of it. That's the nature of the mind. It gets very bored with sensual external pleasures. It needs more and more and more of it. First you have like a half a bowl of ice cream. The next thing you know, you're eating the pint. So, not the pint. What is it? Is it plain? Yeah, quart. You're eating the quart. You're eating the tub. So the next is called Ditupadana, and that really means clinging to our wrong ideas and opinions about the world. The Buddha, in one of his suttas, the second sutta of the long discourse is called the Samana Phala Sutta. He came up with a list of six types of bad thinkers, and he named each of the thinkers of his time that practiced poor thinking, poor philosophy, poor, you know, the kinds of people who walk around thinking, convinced that their thoughts will make them happy, and they have a very strong point of view. And all the points of view the Buddha mentioned had their roots in a very deep misunderstanding of what causes our happiness and our suffering. All these people at his time believed different things. And I'm not going to read all of them because they're very long, but some of them are really fucking funny. There was a guy called Purana Kasapa who was an amoralist and who had a big following, and he believed that the universe is fundamentally chaotic, that everybody's out for their own good, and that the only way to find any happiness in your life was just to grab it any way you can, no matter what, and that was it, because there's no justice, there's no morals, there's just chaos. And Purana is quoted as saying, by the Buddha quotes all these guys, and the Buddha quotes Purana as saying, in mutilating or getting others to mutilate, in torturing or getting others to torture for you, in inflicting sorrow, in tormenting, in intimidating, in taking life, in taking what's not giving, in breaking into other people's houses, and plundering their wealth, and committing these burglaries, and ambushing them on the highways, and committing adulteries, and speaking every kind of lie, you're not doing any wrong whatsoever. That's kind of stupid, but that's what the amoralists believe. And there are a lot of people out there in the world that really believe that. It's actually not that unusual that to run across people who believe, hey, it's like every man for himself, you know, grab what you can, if you get caught, bad luck. But a lot of people believe that. There are entire groups of people who believe in it. There were the fatalists, who are kind of depressing people, they believed all the suffering has already been determined, we've already done our bad karma, and there's nothing, karma or bad actions in the past. And if we're suffering, there's nothing we can do about it. Nothing we can do about it. That was a guy, Makali Gosala. And he said, all beings are defiled without remembering the cause or reason. There's nothing to do about it. Nothing is worth any effort. All of it is wasted, all human energy. We're all powerless. We're all free of any valuable effort. You just hear this and you just want to just hang yourself. And then there's the materialists led by Ajika Kesambala. My favorite, though, I'm going to skip down. If you want to read it, it's the second long discourse of the Buddha. They're long-winded, those ones. But my favorite is a guy named Sanyaya Bellataputta. He was the founders of those who practice doubt as a spiritual outlook. And this is his quote. This still makes me laugh. I read this first like 10 years ago and I just laughed out loud, and it still makes me feel happy just to read this because it's so dumb. This is the manifesto of the doubters. If you asked me if there exists cause and effect in the world, if there are results to our actions, what do you think I'd say? I don't know what I'd say. I don't think in that way. I don't think in any other way. I don't think not. I don't think not not. If you ask me if there isn't karma, or both, if there is and there isn't, or neither there is nor there isn't, if there aren't, both are and aren't, neither are nor aren't, then I still would not think not. Or don't think not, I know. is saying, and that we should be very careful when they stray too far away from the idea that my true happiness and my suffering is anything other than the result of my own thoughts and actions. Now, obviously, some things people do that cause suffering, but the bulk of my unhappiness and the bulk of my true lasting inner peace come from my actions. That's the fundamental beginning of the Buddhist philosophy. And if you find yourself lost in a cloud of thoughts about what's going on in the world and how bad other people are and how you're being fucked with and stuff like that, you are straying into ditto upadana, because you're beginning to say, basically, through your own thoughts, that the reason why you're stressed out or why you're unhappy is simply because of other people or because of other conditions. So bring the awareness back into what we've done. The third I'm not going to talk too much about is sila upadana, sila ba upadana. And that's basically the belief that if the first two was sort of like the first one, tamupasava, the fixating on sensual pleasures is like eating candy. And the second one is sort of like, it's like eating pizza. Your thoughts about the world are very filling, but they're not very good for you. This one is like eating nothing but tofu all the time. It sort of sounds healthy. It sounds like a good idea. But in the long run, you're going to suffer. Silabhutupadana. I can never pronounce that one. It's basically the belief that our spiritual practices that are very ritualistic are the things in and of itself that are going to bring us happiness. And I'll explain that to you. There are certain people who believe that so long as they jog or they do their yoga once a day or they do they sit with their candles and they do they do the bows to the Buddha statue in their room, or we do our little ritual, that's it. We don't have to put any effort into our spiritual practice. We don't have to develop mindfulness. We don't have to practice working with being diligent about what we think about. There's this idea that so long as we sort of shrug like, I'm letting my mind do whatever it wants for the rest of the day, but for those 45 minutes when I'm rock climbing, I'm really zoned in. That's where I got it all held. And the Buddha basically is reacting to a lot of skillful but ultimately misguided Brahmins of this time who believed that if you simply did externally based things like rituals and sacrifices and did these sort of ritual things that look good, that would be the thing that ends your suffering. And the Buddha said, no, there's more to it than that. There's nothing wrong with doing yoga and with exercising. In fact, I urge you to do both. I urge you to do everything, that bike riding and physical activity. But if you think that in and of itself is going to be the end of all your stress and suffering, that's where this comes in. And there's people who fixate on thinking so much about how to turn these little rituals into things that are all-encompassing, that will bring them their lasting happiness, that it can cause some suffering. And finally, the last thing for today, because we're all hot, and I've been taking a long time explaining this, but is atava upadana, which is focusing and fixating on the thoughts about ourselves. Who am I? What am I really? What makes me different from everybody else? Why am I so important? All that stuff. That's the fourth kind. So the four ways we misuse the mind are and feed off of things that cause us lasting mental indigestion is sensual pleasures, fixating on our views and opinions about the world, fixating on our rites and rituals that we think are going to save us, and then fixating on the stories about ourselves. Who am I really? What makes me different? Why am I so important? The Buddha said, rather than all that, start with just seeing which actions and thoughts are causing yourself stress and suffering, and work to change them to things that are skillful. So, that's it for tonight. I really thank you all for hanging in. Now, if there's any questions, I'm sure I've worn you all out besides the fact that it's all really hot. And if any of you have to leave because you're about to faint or shoot me, that would be understandable. But if there's any questions about any of this, now would be the time to ask it. Hi.
Hi, thank you, John. Not necessarily related to this, but this is a question I've had for a long time, which is that it's frequently said by you and many that the Buddha said, don't take my word for the teaching.
Right.
Try it for yourself.
Correct.